Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, August 6th. I'm Ray Graff. Our guest today is a smart dude. He is one of a growing cadre of scientists at the forefront of research on UFOs, or UAP, as the government now calls them. Dr. Kevin Knuth is a professor of physics at the University at Albany. He is a former NASA research scientist who has published over 100 peer-reviewed scientific publications and has been invited to speak in 18 countries. He can be seen in the Netflix series Encounters and in National Geographic UFOs Investigating the Unknown. He is a great guest on this show and a popular one. We'll take calls from you, and you can talk to Kevin Knuth yourself. It's 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Email voxpop@wamc.org. See you after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us once again today is Dr. Kevin Knuth. Kevin is a professor of physics at UAlbany and the editor-in-chief of the journal Entropy. He's a former NASA research scientist, having worked at NASA Ames Research Center in the Intelligence Systems Division, designing artificial intelligence algorithms for astrophysical data analysis. His current research interests include the foundations of physics, quantum information, autonomous robotics, the search for and characterization of extrasolar planets, and unidentified aerial phenomena. Dr. Knuth has published over 100 peer-reviewed scientific publications, and I got to tell you, he is a popular guest on this show, so if you want to get in, call now. The number is 800-348-2551. Last time he was on, we were leaving him on the line. 800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Kevin Knuth, how are you? How's the summer?
Excellent. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great summer.
It's what the reporters used to call the silly season. That's when, we're going to put all, there's not a lot of news happening, so we're going to put all the UFO stories in the papers.
Is that why they come out in the summer?
That's what they called it back then. I got to say, this scientific paper that you and your cohorts released in the Progress in Aerospace Sciences, entitled The New Science of Unidentified Aerospace Undersea Phenomena, is a beautiful piece of work.
Well, thank you.
I've been reading this literature for over 50 years. I mean, I don't know when I started, but I know most of the topics you cover here, and I have never seen a more concise and just well laid out history of government interest, of scientific interest, of civilian interest in UFOs before. You should release it to the public, I think.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's publicly available.
Is it?
Yeah, I have it on my website, and so.
Oh, I didn't know you had a website. Yeah. Maybe I should have found out before the show.
So it's okay. It's knuthlab.org is my website.
I got to check that out. And at the end of the show, we got to mention it again. Okay. I hope our listeners get a chance to talk about this. Before I talk about this report a little bit, anything new since the time we last spoke?
Anything new? Let's see. Well, we've been working to better collect our own data and trying to identify locations to collect data.
So, now, how would you do that?
Well, there was, within the last few years, there have been a couple, reports of glowing orbs in Connecticut, near a reservoir in Connecticut. And so we went out there spent a week out there trying to collect our own data. And my colleague, Matthew Shadagas, really put in the lion's share of the work. Yes, he did. About, two out of the five nights, he actually saw orbs himself. One night he calls me up and he apologizes. He goes, "Kevin, I'm so sorry." He goes, "There was this orb and I could have gotten good photos if I'd taken the time, but I had to see it through a telescope. So I got the telescope trained on it because I had to look at it for myself to see what it was." And he said, "It was amazing. It was this giant ball of fire. It was spectacular."
Interesting.
And he apologized for not getting better photographs. I said, dude, you had to look at it for yourself. That's a good thing to do. You're a scientist. And we hear all the time that scientists and astronomers never see these things and never see them through telescopes. I said, but now you have.
Well, one of the points that you make in this study that you have just released or released recently is that searching for these things in a scientific way is akin to searching for earthquakes. You have to wait. You have to hurry up and wait. So how do you find those spots? Now, I remember this case in Connecticut. There was a News Nation piece.
Yeah.
And there was a video of a police officer down there.
There's a police officer, saw it, yeah.
And it's quite a compelling video.
Yeah.
Did what Matt saw look the same?
It looked the same, yeah.
What scientific data can you seeing it is one thing, but can you measure it in any way?
Yeah, well, he was working to get photographs and use triangulation to determine its position and speed and that sort of thing. In the future, we now have better equipment for measuring spectra, which are basically like taking a prism and breaking up the light into its colors, right? So we're hoping to go back and do that at some point too, because measuring the spectra allow you to determine what's creating the light. And is it a plasma? Is it are they glowing minerals? Are they from an artificial source? Are they from a non-human artificial source?
You should be able to figure it out if it was artificial or not.
Yeah.
Interesting. And you know, I think the government has been since the 40s or early 50s using spectral analysis on some of these things.
But they have, and we noted that in the paper at one point that there was actually an article in the 1950s. On how a professor at Caltech or in California, either Caltech or maybe Berkeley, was being funded by the U.S. government to put spectrometers on telescopes to try to get spectra of UFOs.
Kevin Knuth is our guest. We're talking UFOs today, 800-348-2551. Years ago, I don't even know how long he's been dead, but scientist Stanton Friedman was on this program, and he was always fond of saying, you know, some, and I'll underline some a million times, some UFOs are not our spacecraft. They are alien spacecraft. Do you believe that?
I think he's probably right, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what the evidence that we've seen so far suggests, that some of them are really interesting, probably technologically advanced non-human craft.
What I love about this paper, and I'll just read a little of the abstract here. In this paper, we review and summarize approximately 20 historical government studies dating back to 1933 all the way up to the present. And this is Scandinavia, Canada, France, Russia, China even. And obviously governments have been interested. But now they're publicly interested. What happened? What happened?
I think that somehow the article that was written by Helene Cooper, Ralph Blumenthal, and Leslie Kane in the New York Times in 2016 made a huge difference. I mean, the fact that it was a New York Times article, it was about the Nimitz encounter, which was a naval encounter, and it was that coupled with the fact that the Navy was working hard to get the attention of Congress, because the Navy, at least in 2015, were having near daily encounters with these objects. So they were, so you had the USS Roosevelt in the Persian Gulf, and they had sorties flying into Syria, bombing runs going into Syria. And as the pilots were flying north into the Persian Gulf, they would encounter these objects.
So,
and then they would be frazzled by the time, you know, they're a wreck by the time they get to the war zone, because these objects are literally flying at their planes and dodging them last minute.
But again, it was the leak that caused the public interest, because there's been this interest, Lakenheath, 1956.
Oh, that was an amazing case too, yeah.
Right. And so these cases have had the interest of the government, but now it's in public. J.D. Vance was on TV the other day saying,
right,
you know, I'm mystified by these videos. I'm hooked on these videos. I'm trying to get to the bottom of it.
I would love to see some of these. Yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. He didn't say what videos.
Right. And we know that they're seeing stuff that are still classified. The videos that were released were probably the most boring videos they had.
Yeah.
From what I've heard pilots talk about, and from, you know, looking at these videos, they gave the public the most boring videos, which is why a lot of skeptics were like, oh, yeah, this isn't that exciting. I mean, well, Yeah, but if you listen to what the pilot said was describe was happening before that video was taken, it's remarkable. So
Kevin Knuth is our guest. Dr. Knuth is a UAlbany physics professor. It's UFOs, UAPs, even USO today, which seems to be in. Again, this has been around the literature since at least the 50s and 60s. It's now a bigger deal. It's just Richard Dolan wrote a new book, which is – have you read that yet?
Oh, yeah. I wrote it and I endorsed it on the back. My endorsement's on the back cover. Yeah.
So
that's
anyway,
a great book.
Yeah. It's a nice compendium of a lot of the research. But that also goes back a long way.
It goes back 150, 200 years.
Yeah.
I mean, they were seeing the same things, discs coming out of the water, hovering next to ships 150 years ago in the 1800s, they go flying off into the sky.
Now, are we, okay, do you think that we're dealing with the same phenomenon here? In other words, the same thing we see in the sky, is that what we're seeing underwater?
It seems that way, yeah. Because there are many cases of them going into water and coming out of water. And so they seem to be the same things.
Dr. Kevin Knuth is with us today. We'll take a break. Then we'll get to the phones and your emails. 800-348-2551. UFOs today. What do you got? We had a lot last time. Let's hear it this time. Larry Carlton here on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. He's not our guest. That's the music there. It's UFOs today with Dr. Kevin Knuth. Do you just say UAP now? Do you?
Yeah,
I can't
most
stop.
People,
UFOs are UFOs.
I interchange pretty frequently.
Yeah.
When it's clear it's an object, I use UFO.
Friedman would say flying saucers. He loved that.
Yeah. Well, and there are some cases where they are flying saucers. That's what people observe, and that's how you should describe them.
But the case in Connecticut that your buddy Matt...
That's a plasma orb or plasmonic orb. Yeah, we don't know what that is.
And so many of the UFOs that are reported are just lights in the night. You can't. How much data can you get without having your spectral analysis, your magnetometer, everything else?
Not much. The photographs don't do... hardly give you anything. And so that's why it's hard to get any traction. And it's not clear. When you talk about a UAP, an unidentified aerial phenomena or aerospace undersea phenomena or whatever you want the acronym to stand for, it's a class of things. So they're not just one thing.
Interesting.
And so some of them appear to be craft. Some are balls of plasma. Are those craft? Are they living things? Are they just natural ball lightning type things? We don't know.
You know, in the break, we talked about are governments around the world worried or concerned about this? And you think they might be.
They are. Yeah, they've been concerned for decades.
I think it's, to me, the odd thing is that it's now so public. And I'm always concerned, are we being played in some way? Is it a massive psyop? That's what I am concerned with.
Well, I don't, it's hard to know what the intentions are for making it public at this point in time. Some of the facts about UFOs or UAPs have been known way back into the 1950s.
Yeah, oh no, that's absolutely
true. And so why now so much interest? I mean, part of that is because the Navy was having, in 2015 at least, we're having near daily encounters with these objects. And other countries have had problems like that too. And in one of the Senate documents, they talk about an exponential increase of their aggression toward our military craft.
This report is so well laid out. I got to find this. Is this a histogram? Is this what this is called?
There's a histogram, yeah, and a bar
histogram.
Chart, yeah.
And so this is amazing. It shows basically the temporal closeness of reactors being opened in 1943 and construction and then UFO sightings peaking. What can you infer? You really can't have any definite conclusions, but what can you infer from this?
This is an amazing study that was done by some of the members. It was led by Larry Hancock and colleagues at the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies. That's what they call their intention study. They were trying to look at UFO reports and trying to determine if they could show any statistical significance for them appearing in some places and not others, and what their intentions might be. So this they were considering back from the 1940s through 1970, in that era, how many sightings they had at nuclear weapons-related sites as compared to nearby military bases, as compared to civilian population centers, cities, basically. So they would take, they took a few places where you had, so the Hanford Nuclear Works, which is in Washington, near Hanford, Washington, and there's also a few military bases there, McChord Air Force Base, Fairchild Air Force Base, and Marchin Air Force Base. And in all of those cases, they can compare how many sightings you had in each of those places. Now, they're all close to each other, and it turns out that the number of sightings at the Hanford Nuclear Works is far greater than you get in the other places. So clearly they're interested in the nuclear aspects.
And interestingly, I mean, this begins, this histogram shows the B reactor construction begins in August 1943. This is well before there was a detonation.
The interest in the nuclear sites begins before there was radioactive material at those
Isn't
sites.
Isn't that amazing?
So this shows exquisite, intelligent surveillance going on. I mean, whoever is doing the surveillance knows what they're doing, and it's very clear.
It's like with the drones, however, that were so in the news recently. Occam's razor would say, well, if there are strange lights near military installations, it's probably the military.
Yeah.
I mean, we know we put balloons up after 1945 to keep an eye, high altitude balloons to keep an eye on the Russians and seeing if they were exploding nuclear devices. Could that have been our surveillance way in advance?
Well, it would be weird for us to be surveilling our own nuclear production sites and not surveilling the nearby military bases. There were, in the case of Hanford Nuclear Works, there's three nearby Air Force bases where the number of sightings is far lower than what you have at the nuclear center.
Dr. Kevin Knuth is our guest today. It's UFOs, UAP, whatever you want to call them. The number is 800-348-2551. And we'll get to the phones in a minute. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Lawrence writes in, I realize this is crazy kooky, but here's my theory based on pseudoscience at best. All right, that's a good preface. The UAPs seem to defy the laws of physics the way they maneuver and accelerate. I think they have somehow harnessed and focused gravity and generate a gravitational time-space bubble which isolates them from their surroundings. Due to the proven time dilation effect around strong gravitational fields, they actually operate in a different time frame and slower rate within the bubble relative to an exterior point of view. From the interior point of view, the craft is moving and turning at a non-ridiculous speed. From the exterior point of view, the craft is moving and turning at what Lawrence calls WTF speed. So what do you think? He says, that's my theory and I'm sticking to it.
It's not a bad idea. And in fact, that's one of the ideas that we physicists are kind of tossing around, is that, you know, the accelerations especially have been measured to be on the order of thousands of Gs. In one of the papers that I wrote, the highest acceleration we measured, it was in the Nimitz case in 2004.
Where it went from 80,000 feet to...
It went from 28,000 feet to sea level in 0.76 seconds.
Yeah.
So the minimum acceleration for that maneuver would have been something like a little over 5,000 Gs of acceleration, which is really phenomenal.
So it would have to be massless or something else is going on.
Or something else is going on. And in the case of the 1986 Alaska encounter with the Japanese Airlines JAL-1628, it was followed by a large walnut-shaped object the size of an aircraft carrier for 45 minutes. And this object went back and forth past the Japanese 747 multiple times. And this was recorded on radar. So we have the radar measurements. The accelerations are about 10,000 Gs.
See, I didn't realize that case, I mean, that pilot didn't work for a year or two.
Oh, yeah, he was fired.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember seeing that on the news, on NBC Nightly News with Connie Chung and Tom Brokaw in 1986. I was blown away by that. I was in college at the time.
And I believe, and I'm not sure if this is the same case, but the kind of the whistleblower from the FAA or one of the heads. He grabbed all those
tapes. He was the vice president of accidents and investigations.
Yeah.
And Reagan's science team showed up with the CIA and FBI to collect all the data they had. And he copied it and kept copies in boxes under his desk for 20 years before he retired and then made them public.
You know, there's similar allegations about the Nimitz case. That somebody in a helicopter, a couple guys came and took all the tapes.
Yeah, took the tapes.
What can we infer from that?
We don't know what to make of that. Somebody knew that that had happened. Somehow that information had leaked out. So, you know, one of the suppositions is that the Nimitz Tic Tacs were then actually being run by our government and they knew about it beforehand. It's either that or they were tracking them somehow or found out about it and then moved in and took the data. We don't actually know what the case is.
Professor Kevin Knuth is with us right now. Let's go to the phones, 800-348-2551. Bob is in Broad Auburn. Bob.
Thank you. Dr. Knuth, I have observed you on television programming where you described that 10,000 to sea level drop and with such speed, a fraction of a second. You've basically covered most of the ground I wanted to mention. I think you've done a very good job. But you are familiar, of course, with the standard model in physics of particle physics. And I'm curious to know what your thoughts may be with respect to the ability to overcome gravity, our understanding of what we believe to be the theoretical possibility of a graviton. And have you given any thoughts to how nature may allow this gravity to be overcome? We're familiar with quantum gravity studies and some new ideas about what gravity is, notwithstanding Einstein's warping of space-time. So do you have any ideas as to the possibility of overcoming gravity and the physics or the ideas that may be required in order to do that, and including, by the way, overcoming and shielding electromagnetic fields around a craft? As pilots in the military report, their instruments seem to go dead, and something is happening with respect to a cloud around these spacecraft.
All right.
Those are great questions. Thank you, Bob. It's complicated because it doesn't seem that a gravitational or warp bubble like an Alcubierre drive or something like that that's already been discussed would be a reasonable explanation because we haven't observed any of the effects that would be related to some kind of warp drive or warp bubble. You would expect some blue shifting of light and red shifting of light. And that, as far as I know, hasn't been observed, so that's confusing. With regards to gravitons or other ways for this to work, we don't have any answers. We don't have a good foundational theory of physics that leads to the standard model. And so that's some of the theoretical work that I do and some of my friends do is in that direction. And I always have UFOs in the back of my mind when I'm doing this work to look for anything that could be used or indicative of what the reality of the situation is.
Bob, so thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. You know, you're brilliant. Your coworkers are brilliant. Do any of them ever say, hey, Kevin, what are you doing? Do something more conventional.
All the time.
Really?
Closest colleagues do this. I remind them, I say, look, this is really pretty remarkable when you look at it, and I can't walk away from it. I don't want to walk away from it, and then 20 years from now it gets figured out, and I missed out on one of the biggest discoveries on human history. This would be amazing.
Well, I agree with you, but then again, I'm a radio guy, you know.
Yeah, but opportunities don't happen like, you know, this is more than once in a lifetime opportunity. So I want to study this.
You know, science, with what you do, you guys get evidence, you analyze the evidence, you go where it takes you.
Yeah.
Is there danger when people, and there are more and more scientists that I have seen who are doing stuff on this topic.
Yeah, it's growing.
But is there a danger of confirmation bias? Are you only finding what you want to see?
Well, that's always a danger when you study anything. I mean, that's one of the reasons why it's good for skeptical scientists to be involved, not uber skeptics or denialists, but just normal scientific skepticism to call into question. How How accurate is this data? Do we know that the radar systems were working on the Nimitz case? And, you know, in that case, we do know that they were working because the radar operator was able to direct pilots to the locations of these objects to get photographs. So we know that the radar was working. And so, but these are reasonable questions to ask. Do you know that these weren't some kind of laser hologram? Well, we do know that probably wasn't the case because they were being picked up on radar. Could the laser have been ionizing the atmosphere? We worry about that. I've had many questions come up. And, yeah, you attack this from every angle you can to try to get to the truth of the matter.
I thought it was interesting. There was another report that you guys did around the same time based on your group going to Catalina Island.
That paper is also on our website and was published in the same journal issue as this paper.
Interesting, though, you only had a couple of results that seemed really anomalous.
Yeah.
And most, but you said so.
And some of the things that were exciting. So that was covered in a documentary called The Tear in the Sky, which you can see on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
And one of the first sightings, so here's a spoiler alert, one of the first sightings we have was a bright light seen from Catalina Island that we tried to track down. This bright light moved, was very bright, and then disappeared, right? And it was very strange. We later found out that it was the space station.
Ugh. So
the,
bright.
The app
so
we were, bright. The app we were using on our phone to track satellites was off for, by an hour because of daylight savings time. It was a stupid mistake. But
you guys figured it out.
But we figured it out. But it takes time to do it. We didn't figure it out till after the movie had come out.
Which is good for the movie. I saw that movie.
It's good for the movie, yeah. But the thing is that this is why those documentary movies, you got to be careful because the scientific analysis doesn't finish until the papers get published,
and there
which
are,
is years later.
Like everything else, they're a snapshot in time. I watched one on TV, an oldie.
Yeah.
I forget. It has begun. UFOs, it has begun. Jacques Vallée is on that.
Yeah.
And
fantastic.
Yeah. He is tremendous. I think that there are probably some things he said on there that he said, I wish I didn't say those things. You know?
Yeah. Well, those documentaries are catchy, especially the one in The Tear in the Sky. That's a documentary about our mission to collect data.
Yeah, no, it was
great.
It's
not a documentary about UFOs or about what we found, because we didn't know what we found until years later. But it does document our excitement in collecting this data. And you mentioned Jacques Vallée, which is great, because in the same volume that this paper is published in Progress in Aerospace Sciences. This is the volume that came out in June of this year. Jacques Vallée has a paper as well.
So he's
So the whole issue has several UFO papers. Jacques Vallée's paper is on a landing in Mississippi. Actually, it was it's northern.
Is it Delphos?
No, northern Louisiana, which actually took place in Arkansas because it was across the border.
Interesting.
But it was a landing that was observed that was so luminous that it scorched the trees. And they did analysis of the tree bark and found that it was hundreds of megawatts of power of light.
And they proved that? Or
they're able to show that with the tree bark being burnt.
Right. Let's grab another call here before the next break. Cynthia's in Woodstock. Cynthia, you're on. Hello, Cynthia. Cynthia's still on the line, but has probably muted her phone. We'll give Cynthia one more chance.
Hi.
Oh, hi.
I had.
Go ahead.
So I was asking if you recollect some orbs down in Chappaqua, New York, in 1987. I saw three just sitting in the sky, hovering over the houses silently. And that's all I knew. Watched them for probably 25 minutes.
Wow.
Called the police. They said they had had numerous sightings.
The police said they had numerous sightings, huh?
Yeah, well, apparently 1986, they probably weren't drones, right?
Well, as far as we know.
As far as you know, that's hard, yeah.
Well, you know Hudson Valley was
At that time, the Hudson Valley of New York was had many, many, many sightings for about a decade. So that's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, have you seen anything since?
No, I have not.
What color were they?
I think they were three different colors.
Wow.
I think yellow, green, and blue. I can't precisely remember.
Were they close together or were they relatively far apart?
And they were over some smaller ranch style homes. And maybe the stretch was about five houses.
Wow. And did they interact with each other, or were they pretty stationary?
I'm totally stationary.
Wow.
Did you see, were you able to see a tree or a power line or anything behind them? Because that would give you some scale.
No, it was at night. No.
That's tough to say how big they were or how far
they
are.
It's very hard, yeah.
Well, thanks a lot, Cynthia. Appreciate the call. Let's take a quick break. We'll get back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is our number. Professor Kevin Knuth is here. It's UFOs. We'll get back to your calls in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC, Ray Graff with you. Today joined by Dr. Kevin Knuth from UAlbany. Dr. Knuth is a professor of physics, and he is interested in UAP studies. They do scientific research. And we'll read one email here from Joel. Joel in Blooming Grove writes in, I asked AI if aliens have visited Earth. Here is the final paragraph of its answer. While the idea of alien visitation is intriguing and popular in culture, it remains unsupported by scientific evidence at this time. Kevin Knuth, over to you.
Yeah, well, the AI hasn't read all of our papers or looked at all of the evidence and thought about it carefully. It's what's clear at this point, to me at least, and I'm thinking about how to put a paper together about this, a scientific paper about this, is that the speeds and accelerations are off the charts. I mean,
yeah,
totally unreachable by anything human. And this has been known since Hermann Oberth back in 1954. He gave a talk on UFOs and talked about their speeds and accelerations. He knew they went 19 kilometers a second. It's 40,000 miles an hour. Clearly spacecraft speeds. They knew this in the 50s.
We're coming up on the 51st, I believe, anniversary of a great sighting later. I think next week it'll be the 51st here in Albany.
Oh, wow.
And I'm giving you a whole file on
that's
this.
That's what the thumb drive's for.
And that included some very rapid acceleration as well. So you might be interested.
That'll be cool. And their luminosities are off the charts, hundreds of megawatts, like nuclear power plant amounts of light are coming off of these things.
It's amazing. Let's go to my friend Michael in Troy. Michael, how are you, buddy?
Raymond, good to hear your voice, doctor. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, thank you, Michael.
You know, Ray, I hope you'll remember that I'm an artist and somewhat level-headed.
Well, you're an artist, all right.
I wanted to relate to you something that I saw as a child, probably between 1974 and 1976. I would have been 10 or 12, but I was on the front porch of our house in Williston, Vermont, with my mom and my brother. And as the crow flies, you can see Lake Champlain about 5 miles away in the city of Burlington to the right. So we are at sort of the downslope of a hill right in front of a valley. And a kind of low cloud system was there, I would say about maybe 1,000 feet away from us and about 1,000 feet up. Well, maybe that's not right. Maybe 500 feet up, we saw a light absolutely rock solid blinking on and off in the interior of a cloud. And we watched this light blinking absolutely, you know, still for several minutes. And then a thin strand, I would say, of some material, some maybe gas or liquid, a bright fluorescent pink strand descended from, I would say, maybe 50 feet under the light and eventually went down about 100 feet and then eventually dispersed over 10 minutes. It seemed almost like liquid was disgorged from some vehicle, and my mom and I and my brother were wondering if it was something like gasoline coming out of a helicopter. But the fact that the light remained unmoving in position but blinking for 10 minutes was pretty extraordinary. And then the light just went out at a certain point.
Inside a cloud, Mike?
Extremely. What's that?
This was all inside of a cloud?
Yeah, there was a kind of low cloud over the valley. We could still see Burlington beyond, but I would say, again, about 500 feet off the ground, about a quarter of a mile away, there was this blinking light. And so we could see that when the light was off intermittently from the constant blinking, we couldn't see that it was attached to anything. The light just sort of penetrated the cloud. And then from beneath that light, eventually, slowly descending, was a kind of bright pink, fluorescent pink line that eventually dispersed over time, kind of horizontally.
That's really amazing. And there are only a few cases where you have observed things being dropped or let out or emitted by UFOs. And in fact, in our paper here, we have several what they call angel hair cases. Yeah. And it's strange because the chemist Phyllis Budinger has studied many of these cases, and all of the ones she's gotten actual samples from turn out to be related to caterpillar silk.
Ah.
And in some cases, these have been observed actually coming out of metallic UFOs, like barbell-shaped UFOs spinning, emitting this stuff that, when collected, turns out to be caterpillar silk. So you're left with,
what
is actually happening right now? You don't know. So can you, Michael, do me a favor? Can you write that in an email, write that description in an email, and maybe send it to Ray? And
yeah,
Ray'll
send it to me at the station, Mike.
I would just like to have that as a record.
Of course.
All right.
And I've told this story, and I've drawn pictures of this dozens of times since childhood and shared with people. And I figured, since a physicist was on the line, it might be a good time to tell it to somebody who might actually have some ideas about this.
That's
remains
really fascinating.
One of the most
Thank
vivid
you.
Memories of my life.
Send some, if you have them, a screenshot of some of these pictures, too. That would probably help Kevin as well.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Again,
Thank you.
They're hand drawings.
That's
they're
good.
Not photographs or anything.
You're
like
a pretty
that,
good artist, Mike. You're a pretty good artist. I think it'll be fine. Hey, man, great to hear from you. Thank you, Michael.
Okay, you too.
Thank you.
All right, let's see. We're going to go to Peter in Albany. Peter, you're on with Kevin Knuth.
Hello, thank you. I've missed some of the conversation, so excuse me if not quite on the right track. But I was wondering, I think you've been talking about, I guess, the speed of UFOs. My question is, if there are UFOs coming from somewhere, where do they anticipate they are? In the solar system? In the galaxy, da da da. Where would they best guess they're coming from?
That's a hard question, and I've given that a lot of thought. And in fact, some of my colleagues from SCU, the same people who did the study on the nuclear weapon sites that we talked earlier, are now looking at putting together what the information we have on where they could be coming from. So we're looking at speeds and accelerations a little more carefully there. Given the accelerations, if you can accelerate at 1,000 Gs, which is on the low end of what's been observed, you can get to 90% the speed of light in about 17 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it's still a pretty big space out there.
So there's a lot, yes. But at 90% the speed of light, you've got some time dilation happening. If you can keep that up, you can get across the galaxy in a couple months. That's your ship time, not the galaxy's time. The galaxy will see you taking about 85,000 years to do it. But for the people in the ship, it would be very quick. So it's hard to know where they could be coming from. At those speeds and accelerations, they could really be coming from anywhere. The biggest indicator seems to be that when there is a natural disaster, especially like the Fukushima nuclear power plant that was hit during the typhoon, and you had some release of radioactive material, UFOs showed up the next day.
Now, I've seen this, but how well documented is that?
It's pretty well documented. There are lots of reports. The same thing in Chernobyl. Chernobyl happened. UFOs were there the next day. It's within 24 hours. And in fact, the Russians, Vasily Eremenkov, he's a Russian naval officer. I don't remember what his status was. But he had remarked that the Russians used to move ships on purpose. They would move many, many ships. And they would do that to summon UFOs. So UFOs would show up in 24 hours, and then they would try to study them. So if they're getting here in 24 hours, they're coming from within the solar system.
Or right around town.
And probably actually on Earth. The best guess is they are probably our bases in the oceans they're probably hanging out in our oceans somehow.
That's so interesting. Okay.
I could follow up.
Go ahead.
Done.
Yeah, go ahead, Peter.
How far ahead is their technology than ours to create this? 1,000 years from now?
That's really tough to estimate as well, because technology doesn't run linearly, so it's hard to estimate. I've heard some people, some other scientists who've studied this have estimated about at least 2,000 years ahead of us.
All right, Peter, thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. I mean, are we making it too simplistic? Is the reality of this beyond what we can even understand?
It could very well be. I mean, this is a lot of what gets reported is very strange and very confusing, and it's not clear what that means yet.
So. These high strangeness, weird, mystical.
There's paranormal stuff associated with UFO sightings.
You read Lou Elizondo's book.
We don't know what that's all about.
And if you believe Lou Elizondo, blue orbs were going through his house at a party.
Yeah.
I don't know why you'd make it up, but I guess he could be making it up. Otherwise, something very odd is at
people report all sorts of strange things like that around UFOs, and the best I can imagine is that this is what we would call the paranormal in that case is really just physics that we don't know about. And that they're advanced enough that they understand that physics and actually use it. And so when we look at it, it looks magical to us, but you know, that's
what Asimov was talking about, right?
Yeah, exactly.
John Keel used to collect a lot of that sort of...
those types of stories, yeah.
Quasi-mystical stuff. Number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Bob writes in, after my sighting in August of 2015, I was interviewed in Seattle by Janet Colley, Ph.D., and Thomas Beck, Ph.D. Thomas let me know the Earth is being visited by multiple species. Your thoughts?
I've heard that from multiple people at this point. I'm not sure what to make of that.
Including some military guys.
Including military and government officials. Yep. I think a former Canadian Secretary of Defense had said something similar as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would like to see the evidence. I'm a scientist and I want to see evidence, so that's what I would like to see.
Does it ever seem too much? When you do studies, you have to study a specific thing. All of this stuff going on could theoretically be part of a million different things,
that's
phenomenon.
That's the problem. It's really a class of phenomena, right?
Right.
So one of the first tricks is to be able to tell things apart. So how can we tell what's the difference between an orb that somebody sees in their house from an orb that somebody sees hovering over a house, right? Are they different? Are they the same? And that's some of the first things that you have to do is you start to classify things and then you will focus in on a particular class and study that thing if you're able.
You know, the last time we did the show, or actually the last couple of times and today, we're hearing reports from people. And obviously, I know Mike for 35 years. Mm-hmm. He's not making up what he saw.
Yeah.
He believes what he saw. But you can only get so much from testimony, right?
Yeah.
So that makes it that much tougher because memory is a very malleable thing, too. Can you do any science with that?
It's hard to do science with that. I mean, memory is fallible, but it's not that fallible, especially when there's something interesting happening. If it's something happening and you're not really paying attention to it, then you can't really depend on your memories. But when you're paying attention to it, your memory is going to be pretty good. What can you do with it scientifically? I look at them to see to get a better idea of what the types of objects or phenomena we're looking at, and to decide what kind of instruments would I have wanted to have in that case?
Yeah.
And then think about that in the context of building a better instrument suite, for studying these objects.
Dr. Kevin Knuth is with us for several more minutes. Let's go to Port Jervis, 800-348-2551. Nope, that's not Fern. This is Fern. Hello, Fern.
Here I am.
You're on.
Yes, hi. So I saw something very unusual. It was probably in the late 80s. It was during the wintertime at night. Near Otisville, New York, and it appeared to me like a slow-moving object. And at first, I thought it was a plane, nothing unusual. traveling across the sky, and then it sort of dips down a little bit and then very rapidly zipped back in the same direction it came from, but extremely fast, like much faster than a plane could do it. So I'm guessing it was probably some sort of an optical illusion, and maybe it was lights from the plane as a plane or whatever object it was swung around, and I was seeing the light travel back quickly, but it actually, it looked as if the vehicle or whatever it was itself was moving back very fast.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, it's hard to just go on a description and say what that was with any, I wouldn't be able to be, wouldn't be anything conclusive. Your description is not unlike what other people describe, so and there are, you know, there are some cases you can look at these and think, oh, that's possibly an optical illusion. From what you describe, it sounds difficult for it being an optical illusion. It sounds like you saw something that was moving very fast.
I mean, here's the problem with this, Fern. We have a real smart dude here, okay? But there's not much he can definitively do with this that goes back so far now.
It's tough, and it's hard because these things are seen. It's relatively common. I mean, many people have seen them, which is a little shocking when you look and see how our culture really poo-poos the whole topic. I mean, for something that's seen so commonly and clearly important to people, they remember them and it affects them deeply.
Yeah.
Michael making paintings of what he saw.
And the thing is, it was a very, very striking and very, you know, very unusual. Now, in that area, I mean, where it is, I think there was probably and still is a fair amount of air traffic that comes across that part of the sky that comes into Stewart Airport.
Wow.
And I have noticed that. And so I'm guessing it probably was some sort of a plane, and it was maybe on an approach or something. But the way it looked, it appeared very, very odd in the sky as it occurred. So anyway.
Well, Fern, we're going to have to end it there, but thank you for the call. Appreciate it very much. All right, Kevin Knuth, we do not have time for another call here. So I'm going to have to say early 26, get you back on the show.
Sure.
All right, and bring some of your buddies with you maybe.
Yeah, and, maybe Matthew will join me next time.
That would be fantastic. In the meantime, people may want to check out this report, and I hope you do. How do people do that?
You can Google.
You have a website, right?
You can Google it. If you Google, even if you just Google my name and my last name, Knuth, and Jacques Vallée, and UAP, you'll get links to it.
And you have a website, though, right?
Yeah, it's on my website. It's also posted on what's called the Physics Archive, ARXIV. So the Physics Archive actually accepted the paper as posting, which is really a big deal as well. So
scientific peer review going in?
Yeah, so because it's a scientific peer-reviewed paper, they allowed it on their website too. So kudos to them.
What I was trying to get you to do is give me the URL of your website.
I can do. I don't know it off the top of my head.
You don't know your own website.
Well, I know the main page. So it's Knuth Lab. So Knuth, my last name, then lab, lab.org.
All right. Well, you know.
And then you have to click on the.
That's okay. That's
on
close.
Papers. If you click on papers, you'll get it. So.
All right, buddy. Well, we will talk to you soon, I hope. Support comes from Agricultural Stewardship Association, working to help people conserve farmland and forests in the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve working land for good forever. agstewardship.org. Rhinebeck Artist Shops, offering fine artist materials and custom picture framing in Rhinebeck at New Paltz, serving the Hudson Valley for over 45 years. HudsonValleyArtistShops.com. And Adirondack Experience, the Museum of Blue Mountain on Blue Mountain Lake, hosting the Mushroom Mania Festival Saturday, August 23rd, with workshops, nature walks, and more. Event info at the ADKX.org. Well, we're done. We'll see you tomorrow. It's gardening.